The American Cancer Society estimates more than 13,000 new cases of cervical cancer will be diagnosed this year. There's been a sharp decline in cases since the introduction of the HPV vaccine in 2006. So what would it take to eradicate cervical cancer, and what's standing in the way? This is Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Joining me now to discuss all this are UC Health gynecologic oncologist Dr. Thomas Herzog and State's Newsroom reproductive rights reporter Kelsey Mosley Morris. Thank you both for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Great to be with you, Lucy. Thank you.
Thank you. Kelsey, what are we seeing nationwide when it comes to rates of cervical cancer, and do those rates vary significantly from state to state?
Yeah, what we've noticed is that the Appalachian area of the country, particularly Kentucky and West Virginia, have ranked highly among the states for cervical cancer incidence rates, particularly between 2015 and 2019. That was the highest there. And their mortality rate is twice as high as the rest of the country. Within the last 5 years, Oklahoma has topped that list. And so mostly the correlations have come down to where people have access to care readily. And a lot of those states where it's highest, like Kentucky, have very widespread areas of deserts for primary care and for maternal care. So, you know, screening is the most impactful portion of preventing cervical cancer. And so I think what it comes down to for a lot of doctors is that people aren't seeing as many screenings in those areas of the country.
Dr. Herzog, I mentioned the HPV vaccine when I introduced this conversation. What's the correlation between cervical cancer and HPV? Can you explain that for us?
Sure. It's a great question, Lucy. So the correlation is very high. So if we look at the number of patients with high-risk HPV, fortunately, most of them do not go on to develop cervical cancer. But we don't know which ones will and will not. And that's the importance of screening for these changes well before an invasive cancer develops. But if we look at just answering the question directly, it's well over 95%, probably approaches almost 98 to 99% of the cancers that we see with cervical cancer are due to the transformation of the normal tissue to cancerous tissue due to the virus that persists. So it's persistent high-risk HPV types. There's almost over 100 human papillomavirus types, and there's probably 7 to 8 that we are most concerned about that are related to cervical cancer.
And Dr. Herzog, what about HPV rates overall? I mean, it's HPV rates are pretty high in the population in total, aren't they?
They are. And it's estimated well over 80% of sexually active individuals will have exposure to HPV, in which they would harvest harbor an infection for anywhere between almost something we could not pick up clinically, maybe a few months to years. And so very prevalent, but the immune system often is able to knock those out. And that's where the difference between the low risk and the high risk really comes in, because the high risk are the ones that persist and where they're very good at evading the host immune system.
Kelsey, when we started, you mentioned, you know, this, how states have very different rates of cervical cancer, that they seem to, those rates seem to correlate to screenings and access to care. But I'm wondering, do states with lower rates of HPV vaccination also tend to have higher rates of cervical cancer?
Yes, that is a very consistent correlation as well. One of the places that I looked at was Mississippi. And about 1/3 of boys and girls between the ages of 13 and 17 were vaccinated for HPV as of 2020. And, you know, that comes down a lot of the time to education about whether they need it, and also is, you know, a difficult subject right now with some of the national rhetoric around vaccines, particularly for children.
Dr. Herzog, Kelsey just raised an interesting point. Explain the protection the HPV vaccine offers. It goes beyond cervical cancer, right? Because she mentioned boys getting the vaccine and boys don't get cervical cancer. Talk to us more broadly about that.
Sure. So I think the biggest thing to understand, and Kelsey touched upon, is there's a huge disparity between states and regions of the world in terms of HPV uptake. And the good news is we've seen steady increase, although it's been an uphill battle. We've seen rates approaching 80% in some states, which is great. And as you point out with your question, I think there's a lot of secondary gains to be thinking about here. So we see, obviously, for males, decreased in penile cancer, but also other skin cancers in that area, in the genital area. You can also see a number of head and neck tumors that are HPV related. And those decrease significantly as well. So there's direct benefits to males being vaccinated also. And I think that needs to, it's an education issue that we're trying to get out there. So thank you for doing programs like this today. The other thing is that if we think about the vaccination, and I think too many people look at it in the wrong way, it's really a vaccine against cancer. And I think it's the destigmatization of this vaccine is really important, because it really, the uptake ought to be virtually 100%, or at least they're getting at least one shot, which has been shown to still have a pretty good effect.
So, Dr. Herzog, we've talked about how boys and girls are both recommended to get this vaccine. At what age is the recommendation?
Yeah, ages 13 to 17. And we feel if we wait much later, that often there can be HPV that's already present in the high-risk type. There are a number of programs working on what we call therapeutic vaccines. In other words, to try to eradicate a vaccine or a virus that's already there. So to take a vaccine that would eradicate a virus that's present on the high-risk types. But we have not been able to develop one that's effective yet, although there's a number of programs working on it. So at some point we may have that, but we don't right now. So that's why it's so critical that we vaccinate between 13 and 17 years of age, because once the high-risk viruses are present, we can't eradicate them.
And some kids, you can get them even younger, can't you? I seem to remember that my daughter's pediatricians offered them when they were younger, and some friends, their kids have gotten them even as early as 10, right?
Yep, you can start at 10. 10 to 12 is also very much accepted.
We're talking about what it would take to eradicate cervical cancer and what stands in the way. Do you have questions or comments? Give us a call at 513-419-7100 or email talk@wvxu.org. Kelsey, what are some of the reasons parents hesitate to get this vaccination for their kids?
I think, you know, some of the national rhetoric right now is around vaccinating kids at all. And, you know, a lot of that has been seeded by people who cast doubt on vaccine safety, even though there have been many, many studies that say they are very safe. And I know that as far as the current HHS Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr., he has cast doubt on the safety of the HPV vaccine very recently. Calling it unsafe, saying that it causes cervical cancer, which is not true. And, you know, just a lot of things out there on the internet, or, you know, people doing their own research and coming to a conclusion that it's not safe to give to their kids. But I think especially with the HPV vaccine, there's also the idea of a person's child having sex for the first time at a very young age. I mean, the importance of the HPV vaccine is to get it before you have any kind of social or any kind of sexual activity, because it can attach to certain patches of your skin that you come into contact with any kind of sexual activity, including oral sex. And, you know, anal cancer can be caused by HPV viruses, and the back of the throat is another area. And so nobody wants to think about their children engaging in that kind of activity at the age of 10. But, you know, if you want to provide the most protection for your child and the best chance of keeping this from happening to them, that is what the medical recommendations say.
Dr. Herzog, do you have thoughts on that? Do you think the fact that sexual transmission is a factor in this makes some parents hesitate? Are you with us, Dr. Herzog?
Yes, sorry about that.
Oh, that's
okay. Where I think the destigmatization is so important. And I really think Kelsey alluded to it. We need to decouple the vaccine and the science from the thoughts that this is giving permission to be sexually promiscuous or anything, or giving any of that type of encouraging any type of behavior that's irresponsible at that age. It's really about protection from a cancer lifelong. And that this is the very best age to give it because of the viral exposures that can occur. And so, I think it's really about what would you want for your child? I have three children, and I know the answer that we've come to.
And do you mind telling us what that answer is?
Vaccinate.
Okay. Just wanted to, I thought that's where you're going, but I wanted to make clear. Kelsey, you mentioned how vaccine hesitancy is a big issue right now. RFK Jr. has certainly raised lots of questions about vaccines. Are you seeing the rate of vaccination fall because of all this or at this time?
I don't know about the data yet. I think it's probably too soon for the data, but I have spoken with people in California. There was a clinic worker that I talked to who talked about the youth clinic that she has. She's already heard from people saying that they think it's unsafe, or they lump it in with other types of vaccines that they think are unsafe without really knowing too much about it. But I do think it's probably too soon to see those rates fall, but in terms of what people are hearing from patients, there are some effects already.
We do have a caller on the line. Hi, Greg. Thanks so much for calling. What's your question or comment?
Yes, thank you, Lucy. Thank you very much for this discussion. I want to preface to say that I'm very much not anti-vaccination, but I am kind of curious if there are other methods of transmission for the HPV that are not sexual. My son, he's a little bit older, but we've opted not to give him that vaccine because of the pain factor in it. And he's also very, very unlikely to ever be sexually active. So I'm just kind of curious if I'm erroneous in that assumption.
Okay. Thank you, Greg. I'm going to put you on hold. Your audio is a little bit tough there. First, Dr. Herzog, can you respond to both those questions? I'm curious about the pain factor that Greg mentions, and also if there are other ways HPV can be spread.
You mean in terms of picking up HPV somewhere else besides sexual activity?
Correct.
That's been reported. It's quite rare. I've heard the toilet seat analogy and so forth. There have been some studies that have looked at it. It's still suspect, but it's possible, I think it would be okay to say. And in terms of the pain, most of these kids do not complain a great deal about it. So I don't see that as a major drawback. And if it does occur, most of these side effects are very self-limiting within hours of the vaccine.
Okay. Greg, thank you so much for your call. We sure appreciate it. Dr. Herzog, pap smears are such an important way to detect cervical cancer. Talk about why early detection is so important.
Yeah, the strategy here is really twofold, right? So first is vaccination prevention. And the second one is progression. And the pap test is a way of assuring that these early changes mediated by the high-risk HPV that persist does not ever lead to a cancer. And so we can interdict or intervene so that a pap smear that's abnormal, that's actually causing changes in the cervical cells where they're precursors to developing cancer. The good news is we have usually years to be able to change the natural history, but it's important that we have regular screening. And we made screening almost maybe too easy. It used to be every year you needed a pap test. And now with the better technologies we have, such as liquid-based, where the sensitivity is higher, as well as the detection of HPV directly with the new tools that we have, looking for those high-risk virus types, we're able to stretch out the screening to 3 to 5 years, depending on the technique that's used. The bad news with that is it's easier to remember to do something every year. It may not be as easy to remember to come in every 3 years or even every 5 years, but it's important that we do that and we have our patients do that because we are able to treat well before cancer develops in almost all cases. So that's what the real story is here to me, is that this is a disease that is almost completely, I will never say completely, but almost completely preventable. Well over 90% of the cervical cancers that occur, and you already mentioned the sobering statistics of over 13,000 cases a year in the U.S., should just not be happening. And so using those techniques with screening with PAP and HPV is critical.
Well, you mentioned how it's very treatable, caught early. How difficult is it to treat in later stages of the disease with cervical cancer?
Well, we're getting better at it, but it's still something that I think most patients would never want to face. With the development of new checkpoint inhibitors, immune oncology drugs, those types of drugs, as well as some other new targeted agents, along with traditional chemotherapy, we've been able to take median survival of well under a year with advanced stage to now over 25 months. So we've more than doubled the survival. But still, most of these patients with advanced disease will die from their cancer. And if they do live, unfortunately, many of them are left with side effects that are very significant. So that's the biggest problem, I think. This is a very morbid disease once it gets into advanced stages, where we usually use a combination of all the drugs I mentioned and modalities plus radiation therapy. And so we can have connections between tissues and so forth with holes in the bladder and the rectum and so forth. So you can imagine the lifestyle that occurs with that. So it's best to try to avoid all that and get screened and get vaccinated if possible.
We got an email from Sarah with a question for you, Dr. Herzog. Sarah writes, I've had persistent high-risk HPV for at least 15 years. How likely is it to turn into cancer, and do I need to be concerned about having shared it with my husband?
So the first part of it is you need to be concerned enough about it to continue to have it monitored for progression. And so we have a number of ways we can do that in the office. It usually doesn't require surgery or anything like that. And we're able to continue to monitor that and make sure it doesn't turn into a cancer. Some people just have persistent disease that never turns into a cancer. And that's great, but we do need to monitor them to make sure that it does not. In terms of having a partner that's exposed, that they just need to be monitored as well. So the male, it's a little easier to monitor. It's an external organ, and certainly looking to see if there's any lumps or bumps, new growths or anything. And it never hurts to go see a urologist for an initial baseline exam where they can actually put acetic acid on and screen for any precancers that are there. If not, generally, it doesn't need to be watched a whole lot closer than that.
Kelsey, I know in your reporting, you tackled this question that Dr. Herzog referenced earlier, that's, you know, all of these cervical cancer cases should have been preventable, could have been prevented. So theoretically, Kelsey, is cervical cancer a type of cancer that could be eradicated? And what would it take to do that?
I spoke with several doctors who've studied this for a long time who said, yes, it is definitely something we could almost entirely eradicate. There was a study out of Scotland, I think it was, where they had a cohort of individuals who got vaccinated when they were young in that time period that we talked about. And there were zero cases of cervical cancer among them, you know, 20 years later or whatever it was. So we have evidence to show that it is effective at, you know, completely solving the problem for the vast majority of people. And the thing that it would take is having high access to primary care that would encourage people to go get their screenings when they need them. Screenings are unfortunately one of those things that are easy to bypass. And, you know, especially with people who are trying to prioritize the healthcare that they do have and the money that they do spend, that's something that is kind of the first to go when it comes to making those decisions. So we need that, as well as sexual education for young people that actually talks about the HPV vaccine and the virus and how it all works. And we need those vaccine rates to increase. And all three of those things are facing a lot of headwinds right now on a national basis.
Dr. Herzog, in just like 20 seconds, is there anything else people can do to reduce their risk of cervical cancer?
Well, there's some cofactors such as smoking that can be an issue. Stress, there's probably some nutritional factors as well. But they're fairly minor compared to the infection with the persistent high-risk HPV. And I think Kelsey captured very well what we need to do in terms of strategy to try to eradicate this disease.
Okay. Well, I've been talking with UC Health gynecologic oncologist Dr. Thomas Herzog and State's Newsroom reproductive rights reporter Kelsey Mosley Morris. Thank you both so much for your time today. You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Associate producer is Harper Carlton. Technical director is Carlos Lopez Cornu. Rob Fetters composed our theme music. I'm Lucy May. Thank you so much for listening.